That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. Happy Thursday to you. How are you? Have you had a good week? If you're in the UK, I know it's dropped, it's getting cold, get your scarf on, turn that central heating on. I'm freezing, but we're going to warm things up. It's episode 21. I'm very, very happy to say it's Lorna Nixon-Brown. We've been trying to get her on for a while. As with all our guests, clashes of dates come up all the time, but I'm chuffed that we made it work. And she's an absolute soul. I love Lorna to bits. I know you're going to really enjoy this episode. She is very, very honest. Things get a bit emotional in a good way. I don't want to tell you too much. I'm going to keep this intro short. But I hope you enjoy the episode and I will see you at the end. One more thing I've got to tell you. Christmas is coming. Myself and producer Griff want to compile a best of episode, right? So we've got, up to now, we've got 21 episodes. This is episode 21. What's your favourite episode, right? You must have a favourite episode. I know people love them all. I love them all. Go back through, have a little listen to the episode and pick out a little bit for me. Tweet me, Facebook, email. Let me know what the episode is and look at the time that this little bit that you really like on the episode is. Take a note of it, send us it in, we will include it. Put your name in, maybe you want to say why it's your favourite bit, yeah? And we'll give you a big shout out on the best of the first year of the Two Shot Podcast. It's going to come out, we're going to put it out Christmas or we're going to put it out New Year, depending on what goes on, because it's all very busy this time of year. I know you're busy, but if you could just do us that little favour, we don't ask that much apart from patreon.com/twoshotpod, just thought I'd get that in there. I'm not going to, you know about that. If you want to throw us a couple of quid, you can, but I know you've got presents to buy for. Poor producer Griff needs some new socks. That's what I'm buying him for Christmas. Anyway, this is episode 21 with the quite lovely and brilliant Lorna Nixon-Brown. Enjoy.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
It is funny though, isn't it, about clothes and what they make you feel like. And I just find that about shoes sometimes. I've got these boots on at the moment. They've got like a slight, you know, we don't brand stuff on the podcast, but these are boots. See?
Oh, yeah.
And I just feel connected. I just feel grounded sometimes.
Yeah.
And sometimes you need it.
I don't really like wearing heels because I don't feel connected to the earth. I know that sounds really weird.
No, not at all.
But sometimes, I remember an acting tutor at drama school said to me once, "God, you're kind of better when you're barefoot." How crazy is that? But I think it was so much about perhaps it was that part as well. And but it was a real like rootedness and a connection to the earth.
Yeah.
And I always prefer like a, you know, I don't really like wearing heels. I look like an idiot as well when I wear heels.
Just judging yourself. Stop judging.
No. Yeah, maybe.
Oh, we're always judging. We all judge ourselves.
Good in as well. It's what you feel free in.
Exactly. So, it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. If you feel good about it, you're going to walk into any room
and
feel a sense of power.
Yeah, if you feel free, it doesn't matter what you wear, you feel great.
What was fashion like growing up in Birmingham when you were growing up?
Craig, I just wore whatever I wanted to wear. And I was like a real geek because of it, because I wore like, I would just wear, I still love floral, but I would wear, like, I wear less of it now, but like I would just wear long floral dresses and loads of my great grandma's old clothes. Because she'd like, would in my family, they passed down a lot of clothes.
Heavy vintage
and like beautiful little kind of velvet hats and like long pearl earrings. And I just really expressed myself through my clothing when I was little. I didn't really, you know, I wasn't in with all the fashion at school. Never am now either. I just wear what I feel, like I said, feel free in. But I remember at school people thought I was a bit crazy because I wore just what, you know, whatever I wanted.
So you're marking yourself out to be an individual early on?
I didn't even think of it like that, you know.
What do you think of it as?
To be honest, it's what I had. A lot of the stuff was passed on from my sister.
So it was no choice?
I couldn't really, like, just go and buy, like, every single, like, latest trend, you know what I mean?
But if you had, would you have wanted to wear all that?
Not really. I always looked at like old school classics as well. I loved, you know, like the kind of Audrey Hepburn classic, you know, clothing. And I had all of these beautiful clothes from my great grandma that I still have now. She was so tiny, like I'll never fit into it now, but I still keep them because they're just so beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what was growing up in Birmingham? Were you in the centre of Birmingham? Whereabouts did you
grow up? We were like, do you know the Cadbury Factory?
I know of it. I go past it on the train sometimes.
Really close to there, but not in like Bourneville, which is like the Quaker village.
Yeah, that's just a bit out.
A little bit further away from there, in a place called Cuttridge, Kings Norton.
Right.
I know
of Kings Norton, yeah.
Yeah, that's where we grew up we spent most of our childhood.
When you say we, who was there?
So that's my mum. My mum kind of brought us up, and my older sister.
How old? What's the difference between you and your sister age-wise?
Rose is 3 years older than me, and my little brother Joe. So my family is massive. I've got a huge extended family. I'm from a kind of like a modern blended family, as it were. My dad's got another family. I've got a half sister, Delia, half brother Nico, but it doesn't mean anything to me, like the heart. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, it's all connected.
I'm just trying to give you an idea of like Rose and Joe and myself. We were like a very close kind of knit.
Sorry, who's Rose and Joe?
My older sister.
Right,
my younger brother.
Already I'm lost.
Do you know what I mean? Me too. There's so many of us. There's like my family is huge, but at the same time, we had a very intimate kind of close-knit, like my older sister and my younger brother, we grew up with my mum in Birmingham.
So when did your mum and dad split up?
Oh, God, when I was like 6 or something. I think I was in year 2, so maybe a bit older.
That's six, because my son's in year 2 now and he's 6.
Yeah,
so six, seven.
So they split up when I was, in year 2, and dad, he moved to Paraguay. He was around, like, most, you know, here and there, but he was mostly in Paraguay, where he was working.
Right.
And we travelled around quite a bit before Birmingham. Like, we lived in Kathmandu when I was younger.
Did you? What was that like?
Oh, my God, I can't remember, Craig. Everyone says, oh, wow, you lived, like, in the Himalayas. What was it like? And I have a real, like, yearning to go there. Do you know what I mean? Because I spent, like, 3 or 4 years of my life there. But I don't remember it.
Do you have any... does your... Obviously, your mum remembers. Does she tell you anything about Kathmandu?
She does. She wrote a novel about...
She wrote a novel?
In the Himalayas, yeah. The Himalayan summer, she wrote a novel about it.
About her time there? Was it autobiographical?
No, not at all. It's fiction. But for sure, her experience of living there informed it, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But she's very connected to South Asia. And we're actually working on something together now, set in... Not in the Himalayas, set in India. But my sister talks about Kathmandu with me.
Does she have fonder memories or certainly memories?
Yeah, she'll remember. And sometimes I'll go, oh, you remember when that happened? But I don't know if it's my my memory of something that she's given me, a memory that she's given me rather than my own memory.
Right, okay,
you can see what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
But I just think, you know, when I go there, I think it might be quite an experience for me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
somewhere that you were for the first, like, 3 or 4 years of your life.
Yeah.
And when I go to somewhere like Scotland, which is also, like, where a lot of my family come from.
Whereabouts in Scotland?
Right, Sutherland, right.
Oh, right at the top.
Yeah. That landscape is kind of similar. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That kind of landscape. And I wonder, I'm very kind of spiritual like this, but I wonder if it's something like that kind of memory... Subconscious memory, this memory that of being in that place when I was so young and coming back to a similar kind of space, because I always get this yearning to go to Scotland as well. Like when a lot of my family get it, so, but when we pass, this sounds really crazy.
Does it?
Don't,
go on.
When we're in Scotland, we do feel like a kind of peace.
I know, I get that, I understand.
I find that, I really do. Like you're kind of in your space.
Is it because where you go in Scotland, you don't have other people around, or you have your own space? So you have.
That's interesting. I don't think it's so much about like isolation from other people, but rather like an intimacy with the people you're with. Do you know?
So it's
what I
about
mean?
The
so
people you go to a place with.
Yeah, and I think it's time. It's slowed down. Do you understand? Like, for me, I love London right now. I'm loving being back here. But it's very frenetic. It's so fast for
me. It's full-on cities, especially London City. It really doesn't stop.
Yeah, and I love it. And for me right now, it's the right place to be. But sometimes I long for more of an intimacy here, like a kind of... Like a... It's just like a slowing down. Do you know
like
me?
This?
Yeah.
we're in the heart of Soho.
But you can find it here. You just have to know where to find it.
I was going to say that. You can. Yeah, you can. Really can.
And I didn't know where to find it before, you see. When I was at Drama Centre, it was all mental. Like, we'd be in this kind of close-knit, like, group of people. We didn't leave each other at all. And then you'd be let loose into London. Do you know what I mean? And it was all busy and, like, there was so many shows and I'd never really... I'd been here, like, on the odd weekend trip with Mum and Rose and Joe, but I didn't really know it and it was all, like, a big blur. And now, when I'm here, I'm able to go, yeah, it's still, like, a big kind of frenetic kind of busy place, but I can kind of pinpoint, like, you know...
Yeah, and you can deal with it because you know the map of London more now.
That's it, yeah. You can really see it. You can.
And also, you pinpoint the places you want to go. As what, like what you said, you go, right, well, I need to go to that place, and then I can cut across town here. I need to go west.
That's it.
You make things easy for yourself.
That's it. You kind of, if you slow down yourself, you can see it in more detail, I suppose, rather than a big blur.
Which is what it can become.
It could be, yeah, for sure. And I, even now, I have to leave sometimes. Like this summer, we went to the Highlands, believe it or not. You know, we went to Scotland. My mum, my grandma, And my little brother, who lives in Glasgow now, he then went over with us as well. And Mum and I, we're working on something at the moment, so it was great for us to have that space anyway. But I realised just how much I needed to get away from
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
And then after like 2 weeks, I was like, oh my God, I need to go back to London.
I know, it's funny because when, not to turn this around on me, it's not my podcast, but when I moved from Blackpool to London when I was on the cusp of sort of 17, 18, and I'd never spent so much time in London, I was from a, you know, semi-sleepy seaside town. I just devoured London. I loved the craziness. I just loved everything that was going off all the time. And then when I moved out, I get the best of both worlds. Because you pop into London, you get your little fix, and then you go, oh, I'm back to the sleepy countryside. But it's time, and it's all relative about where you are within yourself,
I think.
Do
you miss, like...
No.
No.
What, miss London?
Yeah.
No, I don't, because I get it.
Yeah.
I get my fix.
Yeah.
I'm lucky enough to be able to come in and generate work in London, but I don't have... that 9-to-5 job, as a lot of people do, where they have to be in London because of doing what we do. I come in, I have my meetings, and then I can get on the train and get back to Gloucestershire. So I get a fix of both.
It's also so much about finding like a community here that you feel a part of. Do you know what I mean? Like, because I felt in Birmingham, like we have a community, like. People take their time, you engage on a day-to-day basis. And then here, I never really found that. Like, that's part of how frenetic it was. But also, I was at drama school, do you know what I mean? Like, we didn't... I didn't give people the time, probably.
But nor would you, because at that time, you were just so focused on feeding information and your skills for yourself.
Yeah. And now I'm like... I'm in southeast London near Peckham, New Cross Gate, and there's totally a community there.
Yeah.
You know, I've got my Columbian Mall around the corner, and I've got loads of friends practicing my Spanish over there, and I run a drama group at Somerville, like community centre, which is just down the road from me. And I feel part of that community. Do you know what I mean?
But you have to work at it, I think. You can't just, it's like with anything, you've got to work. You can't just expect. Things to land on your lap.
Yeah, it's true.
Just going back to when we're growing up in Birmingham, I'm just gonna.
Oh my God,
I'm just gonna pour you some tea.
Looks nice.
It is nice. Let's pour this tea.
I've got a green tea. Should have had a green tea.
No, this will be right. How was school life growing up in Birmingham? Help yourself to milk and sugar.
Oh my God, I just moved the mic.
Don't worry, it's fine. We can cut that bit out.
All right. School life. I went to a Catholic primary school in Birmingham, which I really liked, actually. I'm not a Catholic, but it was really close to where we lived.
Yeah.
And I actually really had a good time there. I did feel an outsider there.
Why?
Because I was the only non-Catholic. So when we had confirmation at school, well, I didn't have confirmation. Do you know, like, you get confirmed. Yeah. And,
was that you felt like that, or you were made to feel like that, do you think?
It's hard to say. I think the majority of the staff made me feel a part of the place.
Yeah.
But there were certainly a couple.
Well, it only takes one bad apple to make you feel like that, I suppose.
Yeah, to make you feel different. I know that I... When the rest of the class were confirmed, they all wore white dresses, and I think I was told perhaps to wear something different, but Mum dressed me in a beautiful
told to wear something different by who? One of the teachers, maybe.
Yeah, I think so. She dressed me in a beautiful well, I couldn't have one of the confirmation dresses.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't really being confirmed, so I wore this beautiful black dress with little roses on it, and I loved it. I think it was great. But when I saw it, I loved it. And, you know, I was very happy with it. And Mum, you know, she made sure that I was happy with it. And then actually when we were in the church and everyone was getting confirmed and getting their, like, confirmation names and everything, I was Saint Rose of Lima. Which is great. But not really. I wasn't really St. Rose of Lima. I just felt like, what a fraud. Do you know what I mean? I remember feeling really like, what a fraud. Because I was, you know, I wasn't a part of it. And
yeah.
But generally, that's being quite, you know, that's, it's hard, you know, it's so hard because actually the majority of the staff there were very good to me. And it was a kind of like a safe space for me, that school. When I think perhaps things weren't always so structured, do you know what I mean? Like there was
structured within the school or structured within your personal life?
Perhaps, yeah.
Well, sorry, which one?
Perhaps outside of school, outside, you know, school. Because of my parents splitting up, which certainly was for the best, but it was inevitably, you know, if you go to a school and you've got that structure and you kind of feel like this is a safe space, then that's important at that time. So I thank that school for that. And then I went to a school really close by called King's Norton Girls School.
This is secondary school?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I hated.
Why?
I hated that school. Because I felt like I was very badly bullied at that school. I just didn't feel like I could be myself there and that I was accepted. It comes, you know, when I was saying that I wore what I wanted to wear and I didn't follow, like, I didn't listen to rap music and, you know, I'd be listening to, like, Eva Cassidy and Joni Mitchell and Al Green and Otis Redding, like, all of my music, when everyone else, like, have, you know, like, you had to conform.
Yeah.
You know, it's just school, it's like school, you know, it's kind of...
And also, you expected. Get into a certain age, puberty but, comes into place.
Yeah.
And, you know, nastiness.
It was an
happens.
All-girls school.
It was an all-girls school. Yeah. Right, okay.
Yeah, and, you know, actually two of my closest friends now went to that school, Chloe and Penny, and they're, like, two amazing women that I love very much. So something good's come out of it.
Of course.
And they're, like, lasting friendships. But I was just too busy in my own world, you know, Craig, like... I'd be in my head, you know, I'd be in my imagination. I spent a lot of time on my own, you know, going off to my drama groups. Couldn't wait to get out of school, go and act.
Was this outside, extracurricular?
Outside, yeah. So was that Birmingham Rep?
Oh, it was Birmingham Rep.
Young Rep. Well, it was like Birmingham School of Acting before the Rep.
So it wasn't in conjunction with the school?
Not at all, no.
Was there any drama at the school?
There was, but it was like... terrifying for me.
Why?
Because it was full of girls who I think that they did it because they kind of felt like it was
status.
Yeah, I don't know if it's status, more like they could piss about in this class.
Oh, right. So, so it would be a piss take.
Yeah, like the, you know, this idea that actors are super loud and the most, you know, the louder you are and the more confident you are, the better actor you are.
Yeah.
This very, you know...
So they maybe saw it as an easy option.
Yeah, for sure, yeah, easy option. And it was kind of like, I did do the drama class, but... Because I was very, very shy, you see. Naturally, I'm very, very shy. And I always felt like, oh, my God, like the quietest one in the group. But then even then when we did act, I loved it, even in that space. And actually the girls were like, oh, you know, this is, you know, they did, you know, respond to that. But it wasn't the same as drama outside of it, you know.
So how did you discover the route for drama outside? Who helped you there? Was that something to do with your mum or was it something
was,
you
yeah.
seeked out?
So, mum, I think because I was very shy, you know, it was more a case of, oh, let's go to, you know, she do acting classes so she can learn to, like, find a voice, you know, rather than it being a profession, it's more of a...
Something to, a tool to sort of express yourself a
yes,
bit more.
Yes, yeah.
Which happens loads, doesn't it, with
yeah.
kids nowadays, too, even if they don't want to follow it. Just to open them up
it's
a little
so
bit and give
important.
Them confidence. I think it's fantastic.
It's wonderful. It's like what you know, what I'm doing with this drama group in New Cross Gate. Most of the kids, maybe they won't go on to be amazing actors. I think a couple of them are bloody brilliant.
Yeah.
But it's more that they're actually like, they're finding their voice. you know, and that they kind of find an empowerment through a character. They find a sense of themselves through a character, and that it's acceptable.
That is so important, isn't
it? Yeah, because when you're kind of so... they feel like they have to be a certain way or they're not going to be accepted into their friendship groups and whatever. There's no way of really being themselves. But then this drama group says all of those rules, they don't apply.
Yeah.
This in this space, you can be however you want to be. You can be yourself in this space. You know, one of the girls in the class, she said to the guy who runs the place, and he said to me, she said, I just love it because it's a class in imagination.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
And I was like, that's it.
Well, that is what it is.
That's it, imagination, and you can be free there. So,
No one's judging. No one's judging you.
No one's judging. You're accepted.
And there's no... Yeah. There's no right. There's no wrong. It's all right. It's fine. Just be free. Be open.
Be free.
And I've said this loads, you know, and I'm sure you know anyway, but, you know, the great thing about children is... when they're acting and when they're improvising, whatever, they don't judge. They don't judge themselves.
Yes. Yeah.
So they're completely open and free.
There's no self, like this hyper self awareness, you know, which is actually the enemy of your creativity and it's so destructive.
Yeah.
There's none of that. It's like, let go and be free.
Yeah.
And it's happiness, really.
Oh, it's what we're all striving for.
Yeah.
We're all trying to claw it back.
Come back.
So, no, did you find that that you had that freedom at the Birmingham Rep when you were there?
That's really good, too. I did. Yeah, I found for the first time a real freedom. It was a massive like an awakening for me. You know, like. I would literally want to run to those classes. We had a brilliant youth theatre director and all of the people, they were a little bit older than me and I'd seen them in other shows and I just was so amazed by them and like inspired by them. And you could be like, you could really go for it in those classes, whereas if you kind of went for it and let loose at school, you'd be like... what a freak.
Yeah.
You know, judgment.
Yeah.
There was no judgment in that space.
Because you're all in the same boat.
Everyone's kind of fairly similar. Like, you go there. It was a kind of, I felt like for a lot of those kids there as well, it was like, it was for me an escapism.
And did you feel it was a safe place?
Yes.
To run to because of... don't want to delve into it too much, but the bullying at school, did you feel that I can go there and I can be myself and I can not be judged and I can express myself?
And I had so many friends, I still do, from that place. Like, I had friends there, like proper friends, you know. And just like the kind of the text they introduced us to, like, I remember the first play I did there was Brex, The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy. And I played a male part. I played Roma.
How old were you then?
About 16 or something.
Right, okay. Still at 16.
Yeah. 15 or 16. Right. 15 probably. And then the next part I played was Antigone. In Antigone. And we did it on silks. That was hilarious. Because I got stuck on the silk. I got stuck on the silk in one of the shows. And it was a bit of a nightmare because the guy playing Creon... Adam, who's still a dear friend of mine, he was having to improvise this scene to try and get me down off this silk. Because I was, you know, like aerial silk.
Yeah.
So I made this lock, and it had taken me bloody months to learn how to do it. But I've
For anybody listening who doesn't know what silks is, could you sort of explain a little bit about it?
So it's like an aerial. It's like, you probably, you know, remember that advert with the BBC advert? Everyone remembers that.
Oh, the eye dance.
Yes. They tumble down the silks and they look so graceful and elegant.
It's kind of beautiful. Yeah. So they would start off at the top.
Yeah.
And they would just...
yes.
Flip themselves down. On a piece of silk.
On a piece of silk.
Yeah.
So I can't do it like that. But I learned how to climb it anyway. And I got super strong. And you have to make a lock to hold yourself on the silk. And when you're right at the top, you can do all these cool tricks on the silk, like hanging through it, sitting in it, making in a little cocoon.
And the play
really
was
cool.
All on that?
Well, Antigone, most of the time, her main speeches were on this silk.
God.
You know, it was beautifully, like a beautiful concept. And for me, like the challenge of learning to climb this silk, which seemed so impossible when I first started out, kind of was part of the journey with this character. You know, she is so determined, this
yeah.
character, you know. Anyway, so I got stuck on this silk in one of the shows, and I could see the youth theatre director Tim just like in the stores, just like about to like jump up onto the stage, like because of health and safety and stuff, like really stressing out. But I got out of the silk in the end, and we had this amazing improv. But that was like that was a very special show for me. You know, I found a real strength in myself through yeah. that part, and I was like, actually, I want to kind of carry on doing this, really.
Was that where you thought, oh, yeah, I think I need to start seriously thinking about training in this?
Yeah, well,
was that a moment?
I didn't know what training was. I didn't really know about any... I didn't know a drama schools existed.
Who was the one that...
The youth theatre director.
Right.
And actually the whole building, and they're very supportive of all of us at the Birmingham Rep. And because I was just going to go to uni. My family are like academics mostly.
Yeah.
That was the obvious choice. I was very academic as well at school. Got all my grades to do English, you know. And then he was like, oh, why don't you audition for these schools? So I did.
Where did he tell you to audition?
I auditioned for Drama Centre where I went to RADA, where I got to the last round, and East 15, I got in there, Royal Scottish, same. Where else? There was one more, but I couldn't do all of them because it was so expensive.
It still is.
It still is.
Well, if not more.
But do you know about this scheme that my friend David is?
I do. Started? I do know about it. And funnily enough, we are recording a podcast with him in March.
Oh my God.
Of 2018.
I'm happy about that.
Yeah. No, I'm a big supporter of David and what Open Door do. I've been behind him since day one.
Yeah.
He knows that. In fact, we were in touch last night.
Oh, brilliant.
In the kitchen. Yeah, we've arranged to go down and do some talks in March of next year.
And
I've said to him, because there's plans to take it nationwide, which I
yes,
think is a fantastic
yes,
idea.
It, yeah.
And I've said to him, I said, look, on a personal note, if there's anything I can do with regards to the Northwest... and inspiring or helping any sort of actors or young kids there, I'll come and mentor, be on the audition panel, do whatever. Because I found out after I'd spoke to David last night, actually, after we were texting, that there's another thing that I'm supportive of called the acting class.
Mm-hmm.
And they've made a film, took this guy called Tom Stocks, made a film about sort of working class actors. And the price of auditioning for drama school is, you know, as we've just touched on, very expensive.
Mm.
And he found out, or they found out, doing research, that he didn't tell me which of the drama schools it was, and I've said this on another podcast before, so forgive me if I'm repeating myself, but I think it's important that a certain top-class drama school makes around £102,000 a year on audition fees alone. And when pressed about where that money goes, there was no answer.
Yeah, you have to ask these questions, don't you?
Well, you do. I think, you know, from all walks of life, everybody should be entitlement. Everybody has entitlement to education and to be asked. I mean, I know when I was auditioning, I think it was around £50.
Yes, that's what it was.
That's what it was. I don't know if it's gone up anymore. I presume it has because it's 2017 and I graduated 20 years ago, so I can't...
Do you know, having those excessive fees excludes people immediately.
Of course it does.
And then it contributes to this, you know, the kind of roles that are created, you know, and if it's only a certain kind of person that will go to these schools, of course the roles will then cater to that, you know.
It's, well, if there's only a certain amount of people, a certain type of people getting in,
mm-hmm.
then it's a certain amount, a certain type of people that come
out.
So it needs to be open. And also, I don't want, personally, I don't want Chris, who lives on an estate in Newcastle, who has a real burning passion, to feel that he's excluded and he couldn't audition for one of the top drama schools in London.
Yeah.
But also, you know, one of the reasons why we started this podcast is you don't have to do that route. That's not essential.
But the drama school.
You don't have to. You don't have to do it. Not anymore. But look, it's a fantastic. I'm not dissing drama school at all. I had a fantastic time and I learned great stuff. And as I know, a lot of people did. But also, there's people that have been on this podcast who didn't go down that route, and they're doing all right too.
Yeah.
But it's just showing everybody that there is a different route.
Mm. But it's such an education into this world, isn't it? If you're not from an acting world, right, going to drama school is such an eye-opener for you. And what a shame to exclude people. Well, it's not just shame, it's terrible. Like,
it is terrible.
To exclude people because they can't afford to go. And it's not just the actual cost of audition, it's the trains to get here. They're so expensive to get on a train to London.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why Open Door's great, because it will cover the costs of all of this.
I know.
Unfortunately, it's great because it's the fact that David started it in the first place is brilliant. But it's London. It's London right now. So, you know, it's absolutely brilliant. He wants to make it regional as well.
But it is fantastic, and David's doing an amazing job.
He's doing an amazing job.
This isn't his podcast. This is yours.
No, but it's very important to me what he's...
I totally agree. And, you know, one of the reasons why we started the Two Shot podcast is to inspire, not just inspire, but help people and just go, look, it's all right.
Mm.
If you want to do this, there is a way that you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't feel excluded, nor should you. Yeah. You're as much entitled to do what you want to do as Tom, Dick or Harry down there in Eton.
Totally.
It's absolutely fine.
You know, think of the stories we want to tell, ultimately.
But nothing should be... The door should not be closed to any type.
No way.
Just get in there. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Whether you're upper class, middle class, working class, just get in.
Everybody.
So you got in, you got accepted to Drama Centre.
Yeah, I went to Drama Centre.
Now, did you... Were you worried about the cost of fees at that point, or were you eligible for...
I got, like, loans and grants. I got a grant, a big grant.
You got a grant from the council?
Yeah, I got a big grant, and then I got the... bursary, Laurence Olivier bursary in my final year, which helped loads.
Which was given...
I got one of them. There were lots of different types of bursaries within the Laurence Olivier bursary, and I auditioned for it and I got it. That was a massive help. We couldn't work then, you know, on weekends, because we'd be at drama school. We'd be at the school. I think it's changing now. I think they're shortening their day.
So allow you to get some sort of job.
That's quite good for people, yeah. And also so you can see London.
And also to switch your brain off.
Switch your brain
off. Oh, my God.
Go and see a play.
But you get given...
Yeah.
You're just crammed with so much information.
Yeah.
It's like...
Just go and cook yourself a good dinner.
Oh, my God, learn how to cook.
Yeah. Like, we were so... I think it's so... It's part of the experience, isn't it? But I do think it's healthier for kids to, like, have some time to reflect on what they've just learned that day and go and, especially if you're not from London, you haven't been able to see London theatre. What an education. What a way to learn to go and see a play.
Yeah, well, it's a great way to learn.
I never really went to see a play until I left. Well, I did here and there, but not really. Not until I
left. I remember seeing plays very late.
Really?
When I was about 14, 15.
Really?
It was quite late, really, because I know people that their parents took them to the theatre when they were like 6 and 7.
Yeah.
I mean,
was that in Blackpool?
No, I think the first play I saw was in Liverpool. It was a Joe Orton play.
Oh, wow.
And that was the one play, and I went, oh, Joe Orton. And I saw this, and it was Loot. It was an incredible play, and I don't think I've ever seen anything like it. I mean, at that time,
yeah,
this amazing sort of, you know, high-level farce,
mm,
but with a massive heart and an element of darkness. Mm. And I just got right into it at that point.
Did that make you want to be an actor?
It's not about me, Lorna. It's not my podcast. But yeah, no. I'd wanted to do that before, mate, to be honest.
Yeah.
But this was a school trip that I signed up for.
Oh, wow. So they took you at school?
Yeah, they took us at school.
That's good.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
I think they did that with us as well. We went to...
But you had great stuff... Sorry, bang the mic. Huh? I'm professional. You had great stuff in Birmingham because the Birmingham rep...
The rep, yeah.
My God, that
there
was...
so many plays. And the kind of text we were given within the youth theatre. We did this play called The Laramie Project. Do you know it?
No.
It's written by an American company, the Tectonic Theatre Company, I think it's called, by Moise Kaufman. I think that's his... forgive me if I've pronounced his name wrong. But he created this show about the hate crime, the murder of Matthew Shepard in Wyoming, who was murdered because he was gay. It's the most awful, terrible thing that happened. And the theatre company created this show about the area where he's from Wyoming, conversations with local people around the time of his death, in reaction to his death.
Did they record? Was it one of those where they recorded?
I think they recorded them, and then actors then...
Verbatim theatre,
I think so,
something.
Yeah. And there's a film, I think they also made it into a film too, but I remember performing in this play and really realising that theatre had this extraordinary power to provoke people to think, you know, to really think. And I remember my mum saw it and my little brother, and I really didn't know that it was going to be any good. I remember feeling very emotional about making this show. But I didn't know if the actual performance would be any good. And I remember they came to see it, and then afterwards they were, like, deeply moved by it. I remember my little brother Joe, he was crying, and I just thought, you know, they'd gone into that show just thinking, oh, I'm going to see Lorna do some acting, you know. And then I was like, okay, this is for me. I want to be involved in this.
Isn't that incredible that it can do that? They just go in with no preconceptions.
Yeah. Yeah, to just go in and yet it can kind of almost change your life. I mean, really can.
Yeah, completely. I still remember when I first saw a David Eldridge play at the Royal Court.
Which
after
one?
I graduated under the blue sky, forgive me for the title change. Have you seen it?
I don't know that one.
Oh, you should read it, it's fantastic.
And what was it you liked about it?
It was a very human story, and I thought it was very untheatrical.
Mm.
I thought, oh God, that's really... I don't know any of these types of people. And I think there were a lot of teachers involved in the play. There was certainly two characters that were teachers, and I didn't know any of those types of people in my form, walk of life at all. But I felt, it's really untheatrical.
Yeah.
But I don't know, there's just something that connected with me. I didn't feel I was spoke at.
Yeah.
I was spoke to.
Yeah. But there was like an intimacy with it, right?
Yeah, real intimacy.
I think that's it, an intimacy, that's what I'm interested in.
But sometimes if I go to the theatre, I want a spectacle.
Really?
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes I want the big...
There's so much room for that.
Yeah.
That's the escapism, isn't it?
Yeah, completely.
And we do need that in life. And life is so hard sometimes, right? Like, you don't want to sometimes go and actually, what some people need sometimes is just to escape the reality of day-to-day life, which is hard.
Yeah.
But that isn't actually what I want to do. But there is room for that, and God, I respect that when I see it.
How did you find Drama Centre? Speaking of hard, did you find it hard? Did you find it enjoyable?
I found it like a roller coaster. Like, I loved it and I hated it.
Did you make good friends?
I made some wonderful friends. I actually saw two of the actresses I trained with, two amazing women, Rosie and Hannah. I saw them last night with actually Annie, who, my drama's acting coach, the acting coach from Drama Centre, who now she teaches at RADA as well now. But, you know, I've made friends for life there. I think I'm actually closer with people now I've left than when I was there. We were all so in, you know, you're in your own space so much there, and you're desperately trying to escape it, but you're discovering yourself, and it's all such a weird thing, such a strange experience.
Well, it's a real catch-22 stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because you want to learn, but you also want to get out and get in the thick of it.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't change it for the world. You know, I would go there again, for sure.
And how was graduation? Because it's an odd time, because you've been stuck together with all your peers for 3 years, and then all of a sudden it kind of changes on a pin, because everybody's wants to get the agent and they want to get out and they want to sort of strut the stuff.
Yeah.
How did you find that?
In a way, I'm not a great example, because I had a very personal... my grandfather died, who was like a father figure to me, and it was so I was very much grieving. I was in a different space, so it's hard for me to separate that experience from the actual experience of third year. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
One thing I definitely recognise is this obsession with our physical appearance into third year. From before, we couldn't give a shit before. Literally, like, everyone just wore what they wanted, and we were all like
sweaty and mucky,
gross, but like we were in our character, we were in the space of our characters. Do you know what I mean? We weren't so hyper aware of our self.
But maybe because at that point you were starting to be judged,
yes,
by the outside.
Yes, yeah. And this is, you know, the problem sometimes with this industry, that for women especially, that there's this kind of hyper awareness of, you know, your physical appearance, and, you know, adhering to this ideal standard of beauty, you know, having to look a certain way. And I felt the pressure of that for sure. And, you know, that's a shame, really.
Did what was going on in your personal life obviously impacted on your third year? Do you feel it knocked you off kilter in a way?
I don't like to say for certain. I don't know for certain, but I know that I was kind of detached from it. It kind of put things into perspective, and I had kind of lost touch with my family because I'd been immersed in this new world at Drama Centre. Inevitably kind of distanced myself from them, just because I literally physically was further away from them, but emotionally too. And then suddenly lost, like, the rock in my family. So for sure it will have,
And was this your mother's father?
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to cry.
It's all right. Are you okay? It's a funny thing with third year. Did you feel that relationships changed within your year? And was there anybody that, you know, you're very close to, and then you've got these people coming in to judge you. Was there a shift? Was there a gear shift within that? Was there anything that you thought, oh, you're not who I thought you were, now someone's coming to look? Oh, is this how it's going to be when we get out into the big wide world? Does that make sense?
As in, like, I kind of discovered a new dynamic to a relationship?
Yeah, I think so, because it does change.
Yeah. I actually feel like I got closer with the women in my year.
That's great.
I mean, we were a small year anyway. There were only five women in the year.
As opposed to how many guys?
There were 10 guys and 5 women.
Right.
Yeah. And I was always close with them anyway, but inevitably there's always competition if you're fighting, you know, there's only one great female part, because unfortunately most plays there's only one bloody good female part.
Sadly,
and most
yeah.
of them are men, you know, like, so we would always kind of inevitably have this kind of a competition. But I was so lucky. I really was so lucky to have such kind of kind, talented women in my year. And now we've just got a kind of a different relationship entirely.
Do you feel it's grown?
Yeah, for sure. My closest friend, Anna, she's a Mexican actress. She actually lives back in Mexico now. She's doing a show in New York at the moment. And she'll, like, send me stuff she's writing and I'll send her stuff she's writing. And she's a huge support for me. Yet she's on the, you know, she's in Mexico.
I know, it doesn't, it just doesn't goes matter. To show, it doesn't matter where you are in the world, support, yeah. and friend, any relationship.
Yeah.
You have to look for after sure. it and nurture it.
And Nadia, like, she's having a baby, my friend Nadia, she's a wonderful Argentinian, Peruvian, Israeli actress. but she's having a baby now. You know, you do find your people in that space. There are people I'm super close with from that.
It's so incredible that so young you did find your people.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I speak to so many people of all different ages. And a very, very close friend of mine who is in his 50s, you know, we were talking not so long ago about only learning in the past, you know, 5 or 6 years.
Really?
About finding your people. I think it's such an incredible phrase and so important.
But you can find an unexpected kind of connection with someone, right?
Yeah.
At any stage in your
yeah.
life.
No, it's really, really lovely. Are we all right? Oh, no, I'm all right. That is a tea interlude from producer Griff's hand, more tea, Vicar. When you graduated and you get that moment when people are getting their agents, and did you get an agent straight away?
I had an unusual experience, I think. I did two showings quite early on in third year. A scenario sketch, which is very specific to this drama centre training. It's called character analysis. Have you heard of it?
I haven't. Go on, tell me what it's about.
It's the work of Yap Malgram, the guy who set up drama.
I'm aware of him. Yeah,
you are aware.
Yeah,
of him.
Yeah.
And it's an extension of Laban's work on movement analysis.
Yeah.
So this is like a movement psychology. So it explores like the inner state of a character and the outer state. So, you know, you will create your own characters and identify a very specific inner motivational inner state and your outer state, which is often there's a huge dichotomy between the two, which is what's interesting, right? So we created our own characters based on this class that we all went through for 3 years, which was one of my favourite classes because we could write.
Right.
You know, we come up with our own characters, and I played Dolly, Miss Dolly James from... Cadbury Village, Birmingham. He was a chocolate girl, but not like your usual chocolate girl, you know. She was a funny old one, a funny character. I did that, you know, I had one of my, had her, you know, the sketch that I'd written for her, and I showed it in the showcase thing that we did. And I got interest, a lot of interest from that, from agents. And then I did another play, The Misanthrope Molière. And yeah. a lot of interest from that as well. So I had actually this crazy amount of interest, Craig, from lots of different agents. And I met lots of different ones and everyone's like, what the hell? You know, and I was just like, I didn't really know what was going on because I knew my granddad was super ill. Like
yeah.
he was very, very, very ill at that time. But I was kind of in denial as well of, you know.
Were you throwing yourself into... the drama centre
yes,
stuff to
yeah,
try and block
yeah.
out the personal stuff.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, completely. And then we did our... Then he passed away. And then we did our showing, our showcase.
Yeah.
To, you know, where you do, like, two pieces and all the agents.
And they're all there,
everything.
Yeah.
And like, all of the... Like, a lot of the agents I'd met, and I was like, hang on a minute, you know, I'm not ready to decide. And playing it cool and everything. They all came to see that. And I think I just, like, if I'm honest, it's one of those things where, you know, I can't be sure because I was literally kind of, I call it detachment, separate, like it's a state I think sometimes people go into, but I detached completely and I, you know, maybe I just was shit, but I didn't, like, I don't know what happened, but I didn't get any interest from this showcase. So I'd had this ridiculous amount of interest before from these other two shows.
Yeah.
And then did my showcase thinking, oh, I'll be a, you know, whatever, just do this thing, like, got it sorted out, I can have my pick. And then I didn't.
How did that feel at that time?
I couldn't care less, Craig.
Because you were you were detached.
I was detached.
And the priorities were different.
Yes, I just went back to Birmingham when I was with my family. And
is this after you graduated?
No, this was just after my granddad died, and that was all happened around the same time. You know, it's very easy to say, oh, it's because I was detached and because I was going through a personal thing. Maybe it just wasn't great that day or whatever, or they just didn't vibe me, and, you know, I'm not going to overanalyze it too much, but that was the situation with agents. And then we did
But also, at the end of the day, you can do all this, but... You know, nothing's more important than family.
Exactly.
You know, and it doesn't matter what it is.
I remember a lovely director, Lorne Campbell. He's an artistic director of Northern Stage. He was one of our tutors at the time, and he said to me, he was one of the only ones who said it, because I think there's this obsession that theatre is everything, you know, sometimes within these schools. Like, there's no life outside it. He just took me aside and he was like, some things, Lorna, are more in life are more important than theatre than acting. And I was like, yeah, no. He was like, go to Birmingham. So I left.
But of course, I mean, you know, I've spoke about this before, but we're all observers. We're all learning from family and friends and other people. If we're not in with real people, then how are we supposed to learn?
Oh my God, as an actor, you reflect life.
Well, that's what we hope to do, that's what we want to do, right? Don't we? That's what we're striving for.
But if you don't know the life you're reflecting, or you're out of touch with it, it's not going to be true, it's not going to be honest.
Of course, you're fucked.
You're fucked. You know, so...
So you went to Birmingham?
So, yeah, I went to Birmingham, and then, you know, I came back, and it was hard to come back, but... like I said, had a good support network around me.
Well, did you get an agent then?
And then I did, I did a couple more shows and got in touch with people who had shown interest before, but actually, like, some new agents as well that had kind of seen me. And I got an agent from, I did a show, The Criminals, Jose Triano, I think a Cuban playwright. I got an agent. I got an agent just before graduating.
And I know, you know, every drama school is similar and different, you know, in equal measures. With Drama Centre, do they advise you to connect with somebody who is in the business to be a mentor? Is that something they do?
So they reminded us. They told us this in second year. Like, have your eye on someone you really like, a kind of someone who inspires you and you like their work. Ideally, someone who's gone to Drama Centre. And then in third year, the idea is you meet that person and you establish a kind of professional relationship with them throughout that third year. There was only one actor in my mind, and that was Susan Lynch. You know her a little bit.
I'm aware of her work.
I wrote to her. I'd seen Nora, and I I mean, it's so hard to even describe, like, her work. Do you know what I mean? Like, she's such an extraordinary actor.
She is, but let's not wax lyrical. About her.
Oh my God, I could sit here for hours. How cringe.
We haven't got time. We'll do a Susan Lynch special podcast, Lorna.
I'll be her agent. But I wrote to her anyway. We met up in Holloway Road and she was pregnant with Hardy. With
I'm aware of him too. Yes.
And she said to me, "This is perfect timing because I'm going to be a mummy and I'll be your acting mummy." And she has been.
She has, yeah.
And more. She's just been brilliant for me. Just very on a personal level, so much. Yeah.
And how have you dealt with the? See, the thing is, at drama school, the positivity is so strong. I feel.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Even though there's a real sort of breakdown and build up mentality. The positivity's there because you're all peers together and you just want to get it done, you want to learn, you want to get out there. And sometimes it just doesn't go that way after you graduate. How have you dealt with the darker times and the, if you've had the disillusionment, I suppose, if there has been that?
There is this idea it's going to be easy and you're going to have work all the time.
Yeah.
There's no, there was never any, apart from the character analysis classes, we weren't really encouraged to think about creating work ourselves. And now literally everyone in my year, we are creating our own work, all of us in different ways. We're storytelling still, but in different ways, you know. Whether that's directing, writing, producing, acting, musician or whatever. But I, I've had some real highs and lows, Craig. And I think part of the lows is, I think it's important to separate just a kind of, a very natural feeling of sadness, and a low feeling with a kind of
sadness
and a depression, and more of a a chemical imbalance. And do you know what I mean?
In a way, what do you mean? A sadness of not succeeding in a way you want.
Sometimes in life, you don't. I think this idea that we're constantly happy is
that's a myth.
It's a myth, right? I'm not like.
Although I do think I was talking to listen to somebody the day going, look, you've got to wake up and. In fact, it was Miranda Sawyer.
Mm.
And I was listening to her and she was going, do you know what? Today I'm going to wake up. I am going to be happy.
Yeah.
I'm going to make that decision and I'm going to be happy.
Yeah.
And in a way, and I've met and worked with a lot of people and I go, that must take a lot of effort for you to be this miserable every day. Isn't it much easier to try and be happy with the best will in the world? And trust me, I have dark times and dark days and it's really odd. You have to pick yourself up and go, you know what? Actually, I'm going to be happy for a bit.
For sure.
It is a slightly easier road.
For sure. But there is a, there is, like my sister, I'm sure she won't mind me saying, but she has like a lot of mental health struggles. She has bipolar. I'm sure she won't mind me saying that. And she, it's out of her control.
Yeah, you know? Of course.
She has no control over that. And she's so aware of the impact it has on other people. It's not at all selfish, you know? Like this, I didn't understand depression until I experienced it. I kind of felt like, sort yourself out. You know, how terrible is that? I felt like, sort yourself out, you know? Like, you have this idea that she had some kind of control over it. And that is so detrimental. That is so bad for the people who are experiencing that.
Yeah.
And so what I'm trying to do here is separate that kind of clinical, that kind of imbalance there that people have, and these feelings of sadness where you can go, hey, get yourself together. This is just a natural, I'm feeling a bit low today. I need to exercise. I need to be proactive and do something about it. Do you see what I mean?
Oh God, if there's an imbalance, then God, it's so easy for me to go, do you know what? I'm going to try and be happy today. Sometimes you just don't want to do. You don't want to do that, and sometimes you cannot.
Yes, I think it's mentally so important to or physically
you can't do it. Yeah. Of course, it's so important. For sure. Oh my God, don't get me wrong. Yeah. I wasn't meaning.
No, I know, but you know, I think it's generally with this conversation, we do need to be clear about what we talk about. This feeling
absolutely.
Of sadness,
yeah.
Which where you can go. These are the things that I can do. I mean, you can always do something. My sister can still do something. You know, but it's and she is wonderful. Like she helps herself so much, and I'm so proud of her. She's doing a PhD. She has a little boy.
Wow.
You know, I saw her at the birth of my nephew Idris. She's an amazing woman.
But also, but it's very easy for someone to say, "Oh, I'm a bit down. I'm depressed." Well, actually, you're not. Because I know two or three people who are very close to me in my life who really are,
yes,
and
exactly.
they have no control
exactly,
over that.
Exactly, Craig, and that's the difference I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And with that feeling, this other feeling, there is you have the power to do something about.
Of course.
And I think exercise is a huge part of that.
It's been spoken about.
Yeah.
I know about that, but it's been spoken about on this very podcast more than once. Exercise,
for sure. Exercise.
Is such a key thing.
Totally, that you can. Well, first of all, you will lift your mood.
As hard as it is to go out and actually do that after that 45 minutes, that hour, however long you do, something releases and it is fantastic.
It's fantastic, and you find that. Like today, I did like. here we go. I did like an hour of I danced. Do you know what I mean? I danced. I feel so good when I dance. I did like an hour of. Samba, salsa, I just don't.
I could see you doing
that. Do you know
that.
What I mean?
Like,
and I feel so much better for it. But if I don't listen to music or dance for a couple of days, I'm like, okay, I don't feel great. I don't feel right. And that's for me. That's what I need to keep.
Because we all, you know, we've spoken about finding our people. We all need to find our thing.
Yes.
That lifts us out of whatever. If we're stuck, we need someone to help us out.
Yeah.
You know,
I have a kind of I think it's relevant because we're talking about mental health here, I want to talk about it. I had thyroid cancer in 2015, and my relationship with mental health since thyroid cancer is very complex. And I think it is for so many people who have survived a kind of life-threatening disease or gone through a life-threatening, experience, whether it's a disease or an experience, there is this general idea that you are, there's an initial high people often get, and you're often seen as this inspirational figure, right? That you have to kind of adhere to this kind of image of someone who's super inspirational. And most of the time I feel I am kind of proactive and I have a new lease for life. But from conversations I'm having with people who have experienced the same thing as me, that there's feeling other complex feelings as well, and anxiety and survivor's guilt and a whole range of other emotions.
Yeah.
And we do feel this pressure to kind of be this, do you know what I mean? This
right thing. On.
And the very fact I'm saying this brings me huge guilt for saying this, because I'm like, well, I've survived, why am I complaining?
Yeah,
but it's
it
a
shouldn't.
Very real feeling.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And I'm actually, you know, I wrote this play soon after this, I got my all clear, because I was on this mental high, like super, super high.
And you just went, I need to be creative and let this out.
Yeah, I need to be creative. I'm on this high. So
is this the one woman show?
Yeah, you know about,
I've only heard through the grapevine. The grapevine being called my wife, yeah.
So I wrote this play and it was super inspirational. And it was true to my experience at that time. But then I crashed because inevitably if you have a euphoric high... for me anyway, I couldn't sustain it and I crashed.
I don't think anybody could. I mean, with massive highs come extreme lows.
Extreme lows, and I had an extreme low, which I'm totally out of now. And I started to feel, and I'd been speaking to people who had gone through thyroid cancer. This is the kind of cancer I had specifically. And they were telling me about these other feelings they felt, like survivor's guilt, this feeling of needing to make the most of every day. And if you don't, if you have a day where you don't make the most of it, you're unworthy of, you know, these very complex feelings.
Yeah.
And then they're difficult feelings.
Yeah, of course.
But I just totally ignored them because they weren't the feelings I was experiencing at the time. So, yeah, I read my play again. I read it and I was like, this is actually irresponsible of me to make this play because I'm supposed to be, if I'm the person who's going to write about this feeling, about this experience, and most people are saying it's so much more complex than just like, I'm a survivor, I'm going to do a marathon, I'm going to do this, and everything's great, and I've survived. It's actually doing a great disservice to those people. So
yeah, but
I rewrote it.
I hope you don't mind me saying that what you were writing about was your personal journey. Mm. It wasn't about anybody else.
But it was specific to that time, and I represented it as an entire kind of collective experience. Do you
okay.
see what I mean?
Okay, I get your point.
I
yeah.
see what you mean. Like, we all, like, as an individual, we have a story we're telling, but I'm supposed to be representing a group of people here,
okay,
right?
Okay, I'm with you.
And if not many people are doing that, I have a responsibility there, so I rewrote it.
And how did you feel after the rewrite?
I felt like it was honest. And I met with Birmingham Rep last week to talk about it, and we'll see like where it goes. But I want it to be like for sure like life affirming and hopeful.
Well, it can only be that because it's come from a place of truth. It's come from you, so
it can only be that.
Yeah,
because it's honest. So and I've met some wonderful people through it, through the Butterfly Thyroid Cancer Trust. And through Get Ahead Charity, I ran a marathon for them when I was in my euphoric high with my super crazy energy, which I have to, I've still got it. It's kind of more, it's calmer now. It's steady.
Comes in waves.
It comes in waves. Yeah. I have to slow down sometimes and say, give yourself a break. I also physically feel kind of, because I have less thyroxine, because I have half a thyroid, I have less thyroxine, this hormone which regulates... you're so many things, you need it to function basically.
Yeah.
I have half the thyroid, so half the thyroxine. Well, it's supposed to kind of compensate for the other side, but inevitably it's a little low. And I'm not taking the thyroxine drug at the moment. So I physically get tired sometimes more than usual, but I have this like uber energy. So it doesn't always work out, but you manage it. And generally, my whole outlook on life is different now.
And do you feel, as much as you went into it loving the acting side, mm. do you feel you're slightly moving away from that because you're opening up with writing, and I know that you've just produced your first film.
Mm-hmm.
Or do you feel that acting is something that you still would like to pursue more than what you've been allowed to?
I think it will always be a part of me. It's like, I know it sounds really cringy, but it's actually, it's like, it's within me.
It doesn't sound cringy at all.
It's within me and it will always be. But I find the passivity of being an actress or an actor at the moment very difficult. And I find immense joy in writing and producing and storytelling in another way.
Because you have the need to be creative.
Yes.
And you have to have that outlet.
Yeah,
I don't.
Absolutely.
Sorry, that sounds like I'm putting words in your mouth, but do you know what I mean?
That outlet. Yeah, absolutely. And it's immensely fulfilling. Absolutely.
But you're in a good place.
Today? I'm in a good place. I think part of it is recognising that you do have ups and downs, you know, and that's all right to have ups and downs. But I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful.
Lorna, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, Craig.
And there we go. Another episode down. I love sitting down with Lorna. It doesn't happen a lot. Certainly not in this context, this one-on-one. And I know that she was slightly worried a couple of days after we recorded it, I think. I mean, I know she enjoyed it, but I think she was worried that she got a little bit upset. I went back and listened to the episode, and so did somebody who's very close to her as well. And I was really, really proud of her. She's so honest and open. And yeah, Lorna, if you're listening, I love you to bits, and I'm thrilled that you came on. And I know that everybody who listened to that episode is going to love it. I hope it touched a chord with you. Well, that's it. Next week is episode 22. Is it our last one before Christmas next week? No, it's not. Producer Chris. No, it's not. Anyway, episode 22 next week. Remember, we are at Two Shot Pod on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Maybe you want to drop us a line. It's twoshotpod@gmail.com. Yeah, drop us an email if you want. Also, hit subscribe. Yeah, if you hit subscribe, you'll get the episodes into your podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts every week. And also, if you would rate and review us, that would be so nice. I'm not one for chart position, but I am saying we've been number one quite a few times, and it puts a smile on producer Griff's face. So don't do it for me, do it for Griff. Thank you so much for downloading, joining us here. I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been producer Griff. He's got a little tear in his eye. Cheer him up. I'll see you next week. The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.
Some people take the straight path in life, but at Arizona State University, we respect your twists and turns. They make our online students more driven to excel in their professional lives. That's why our personalized suite of services empowers you with innovative resources and staff that sticks with you.
Make your next turn with one of our 300-plus programs at ASU, number one in innovation for 9 consecutive years.
Visit us at asuonline.asu.edu to learn more.